Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is A.M. Holmes, whose latest book is a memoir, The Mistress's Daughter. Among her novels are This Book Will Save Your Life, Music for Torching, The End of Alice, Jack. This is what, six, seven novels?
Something like that, yeah.
And one collection of short stories.
Two collections of short stories.
Plus some screenplays, teleplays, some of which I want to get into a little later. But let's start with The Mistress's Daughter. You were adopted as a baby. You never knew anything about your original parents. You were not told anything, so you kind of hoped Jack Kerouac was your father.
I knew that my parents weren't married and that my mother had been young and single, that my father was married and had another family.
Were you told specifically? Do you remember being told when you were adopted, or is it just something that you always knew?
No, I think the good news is it really is something I always knew, and I think that's good for me in the sense that it was just an integrated part of my growing up. There was no dividing point until things happened much, much later when the biological family came back to find me.
At the beginning of the book, you sound very angry. I'm not sure if the anger had to do with your mood at the time, or were you just really angry about how things were playing out, but there's a lot of anger in there.
It's interesting. I don't think of myself as being angry at the beginning of the book. I think in many ways, for me, the one little sort of flare-up of anger that would be obvious to the reader is in the chapter called like an episode of L.A. Law, which is essentially a deposition of my biological father. I wasn't so much angry when all these things were happening. I think I just really felt the peculiar sensation of a rug being just yanked out from under and all of my life being kind of thrown into question.
Because all that happened was that you received, actually your parents received, your adopted parents received a phone call from an attorney saying that your biological mother wanted to get in touch with you.
Yeah, exactly.
Your parents were debating whether to tell you, and you kept going, this isn't your choice, this isn't your choice.
Yeah, it's interesting that it read to you as anger. I don't think I felt particularly angry. I mean, I thought, it seems to me that an adoption, it's a very odd thing. The adopted person actually never becomes an adult, and that 32 years later after I was born, the lawyer would call my parents and sort of put the burden of deciding whether to tell me or not tell me on them. I think my adoptive parents were angry. I mean, they felt that they had put a lot of effort into raising me. I was not an easy child by any means. And they worried, I think, that they would somehow lose me to this new biological family. I think they also worried that my biological family would hurt me or disappoint me in some way. So they were actually angrier than I was at that point.
You say adopted people are children, are always children. You say that as if when you've talked to other adopted people, they have the same tale.
Yeah, I think that tends to be part of the adoption system is one that sort of always pretended to be in the best interest of the child. And the fact is, it was largely about protecting the identity of a birth mother, that a young, unwed woman could give a child away and not have her identity ever known, and also to protect the concept of basically white families adopting white children, that they would just assimilate them into their families. Traditionally, you know, adoption law has not been in any way really about the best interests of the child. And I think there still is that. I mean, the laws actually really haven't changed, and they vary state by state. But one thing that people have been talking to me a lot on this book tour has been about a person's right to know who they are. And I think fundamentally the most basic right is your right to know who you are. And the fact is that in every state in this country, the laws are different, that in most states, if you are adopted, you can't ask the simple question, where did I come from? The answer is, we can't tell you that.
Well, I know who my parents are, and I still don't know who I am, and I kind of figure I never will. I mean, which brings up, of course, a serious question about the nature of what is identity.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that in many ways, this book, too, it's not just about being adopted. It's about how you begin to address those questions, which can come up for anybody at any point in their life, of who am I and who am I in relationship to my family? How do I define myself in agreement or opposition to them? And how also much our sense of self is strung on this fine narrative that is really a made-up story. It is the family story, the agreed-upon narrative. But how you begin to realize, I think, as you get older, that that family story really is a construction and there may be incredible structural flaws in it.
Also, like in any narrative, like in any novel, what happens on page 300 could change every single idea, every single perception that's gone on before.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the thing, and I think most of us don't realize that. We just assume what we are told is true.
When you're writing a novel, In an interview, you talked about finding an angle of attack.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The thing to get you starting off with. Now, this began as an essay, but you still needed an angle of attack when you began. How did you do that? How did you find a way to talk about yourself?
It actually didn't begin as an essay. It was always in progress of being this book, but everyone thinks because they read the New Yorker piece that it started that way. I think for this book, it isn't so much always an angle of attack. It's about sort of the pitch or the tone in almost a musical sense. And for this, I really started off by just thinking, I have to organize this information. I have to just get the story down. So it was really about just sticking to the facts as much as I could and being, in a way, distanced from it and just saying, you know, in December of this year, this is what happened, and starting to tell the story and knowing that the story itself had a kind of engine of its own and a lot of power of its own. But it is sort of about finding that intonation almost of where you're going to, you know, start.
And as you began, the story only can take you a certain place, which is half the first half of the book. I mean, the second half of the book is about, totally about identity.
Yeah, and to my mind, it's funny, the first half of the book is sort of a standard narrative. It is a story, a very simple kind of a story. And to me, the second half is really taking that narrative and whacking it with a sledgehammer and really dealing then with what the rubble is and what identity is and how you begin to look at it and how as you open it, it shifts too, and who you think and what you think move around. And, you know, the fact of living with that there are no real hard answers for who we are, but it's also the combination of who do I believe myself to be and who do I aspire to be and how do I cross the gap between those two things.
Okay, you're not the daughter of Princess Grace and Prince Rainier, but you are the daughter of a businessman from Washington and a woman who wound up in Jersey, a very kind of strange woman. Yet at the same time, you also discovered that your antecedents go back so that you could join the DAR. In terms of identity, does that really change who A.M. Holmes is?
No, but I think that the thing that was most important about all that for me was that as a kid, I was a very angry kid, and I really felt rejected and on the outside of something. And I think my parents always used to say, well, we are your family. And I would say, you are not my family. You know, living in a family for 40-some years, it actually became my family, regardless of my, you know, early anger. But to go back to what you were saying, I think I always felt that my position on the earth was very tenuous, and at any moment it could be revoked. And as a teenager, that also meant that at any moment I would revoke my own position here on the earth. I felt I didn't belong here. You know, I'd go shopping for toilet paper, and I'd buy one roll, figuring I'll be dead before I need another. And it was really awful. And I think the process of getting older and the process of writing this book and really finding all of those sort of threads of attachment, of roots, and really beginning to sort of describe myself as a person who is from a much larger world and who is German and Russian and Irish and English and from farmers in North Adams, Massachusetts, and all of these things put together, I don't feel that my position is so tenuous anymore. I think it also in many ways fits with, I've been fortunate and I've had a lot of success in my life as a writer, and I have a public life, and I am, you know, known with quotes around the word known in the sense that I have a lot of people who have a connection to me and know who I am in some form, and that also helped make me feel like I'm not just going to evaporate at any moment.
Celebrities sometimes feel even more disconnected because the public and private persona are so different. Now, you don't have that as a writer. I mean, you don't have a public persona or much of one. So it's easier for you, I would guess.
Well, yes, it's easier for me than it is for Brad Pitt. Do you ever think about the children of celebrities? Like, think about Tom Cruise's adopted child. I mean, how weird must that be? It's weird enough to be anybody's child, but to be the child of a celebrity. And I was noticing the other day, Brad Pitt and Maddox and Angelina Jolie all walking down the street, all wearing sunglasses. So basically, the minute you're adopted, I think they give you a pair of sunglasses. And I've decided that the reason celebrities wear sunglasses is so that we can't really know their expression at any given time. Because when you really can read a person by their eyes, and if their eyes are shielded, you can't really tell too much about what's going on.
Your first novel, Jack, is about a teenager who discovers his father is gay, and obviously that changes him. So we're talking in your very first novel, which you wrote as a teenager, we're talking about these same issues arising then, and it sounds like on one level or another, it has to inform every single piece of your work.
I think on one level or another, it probably does. I mean, I also write constantly about that exact space between our public and private selves, that we have an image that we present to others and that we really struggle with how to sort of keep that either secret or somehow to not truly be known by others, because God forbid if they should really know you, they might be upset or disgusted.
As this goes on, you meet this woman. When you met her, your reaction was obviously very sharp and severe, but did you feel some kind of connection? Did you feel no connection?
The first time I met her was
at a book party.
Well, she stalked me to my reading. Let's be really kind of clear about it. She kept saying things to me. First, she called a bookstore in Washington and said, there's a writer named Amy who's from Washington. And they said, you must mean A.M. Holmes, and here's her phone number. And she called me up, and she said, I know who you are, and I know where you live. Very relaxing message to get on your machine. And she would say things like, do I have to come to Columbia University and stand in line and get your autograph? And this was very early on in our, quote, relationship, or in our, you know, reunion, if you want to call it that. And I said at the time, I said, you know, Ellen, you decided to come back after 32 years. This is going to take me a while to process, and I really need some time to figure it out. And you can't come to Columbia University. You can't come to my reading. I'm about to go on book tour. It was literally as Country of Mothers was about to come out. And I said, I have to be able to do my job and not be afraid of you, which seemed like a basic enough thing. And then the first reading I gave in Washington, D.C., where my whole family was, she appeared out of the blue. And it really was profoundly clear to me that everything about whatever this relationship would be was about her needs and her desires. And, you know, that's a problem, that somebody can't respect another person's need, especially this is the person that supposedly she loves more than anything but gave away. And it was just so clearly confused for her.
Did you feel any subliminal genetic connection at all?
Well, you know, that first meeting was in a way so brief, and I had a huge bandage over one eye. I had stuck the newspaper in my eye the day before and cut my cornea, so I had a very narrow circle of vision out of the other eye, and I really didn't see her for long, and I really was so terrified and so uncomfortable that she was in this space where all of my family was, and people who didn't even know that this was going on in my life. My adoptive parents knew, but my grandmother didn't know, my cousins didn't know, people I'd gone to literally junior high with, plus there were all these media people there who I was going to be interviewed by, you know, a half an hour later. So it was very, very stressful, and I didn't even have a chance to sort of find or not find a connection. The one other time I actually sat down with her was at the Plaza Hotel in New York, and I really felt that she was playing out some fantasy that she'd had for a long time. She showed up in her kind of rabbit fur coat that I really do suspect my father gave her, her hair up in a beehive, and yet this is, you know, the end of the 20th century, and she's wearing like 1950s hair. And she orders, you know, a Harvey's Bristol cream and a lobster. Every time she looked at me, it was as though she was seeing some other person, had nothing to do with me, plus, interestingly, whatever she was seeing disappointed her. And I never said this, and I don't really write it in the book, but I remember thinking, I'm more educated than you are, I'm more successful than you are, I'm wearing better clothing than you are. How dare you be disappointed in me? And P.S., what is that about? But I really registered that she was not happy with what she was even finding. And that was really more upsetting in some ways than everything else.
It sounds like you also, to that degree, to some degree at least, had a similar reaction from your father, though, I mean, he was proud to have a writer as a daughter, yet at the same time, he avoided you like the plague after a while because of his wife, I guess.
Well, I think his thing was so odd was that he would look at me and say, you know, you don't know what it does to me to look at you. And it was clearly some sort of quasi-sexual reference that I think was about looking at me and seeing my mother or some very strange thing. I think what was sort of interesting and awful about all of this is both of these people were so profoundly narcissistic, and all of my interaction with them had nothing to do with me, which was truly incredibly painful and also odd because I had achieved a measure of success in my life, and I was a person and am a person that you would think most people would be proud to have as their child, but they weren't even interested in knowing that person. It was something about their own needs and their own fantasies, which is really kind of weird.
Now, the weirdest thing comes later when your father tries to make sure on some level that that nobody really knows whether you're his daughter or not, because he withholds the DNA test. Your suspicion is it has to do with his estate at some point. And yet, you know, you're a person who's, you know, hell, you've written, been a writer and producer on The L Word. You're extremely successful. You don't need his money.
I don't want his money. I would never take his money. When he asked me, when we first met, if I would be willing to take a DNA test, it was ostensibly because that would allow him to take me into his family, that his wife wanted a test to prove who I was. And other people have since posited the idea that he actually wanted me to have a DNA test so he could willfully exclude me from his family, and that you only can exclude somebody by, in a way, identifying them. You know, the truth is I don't care about his estate. I would never be able to accept something from his estate because it's just very tainted money. I'd have to give it to, like, charity immediately or something. But that said, even a few weeks ago, People Magazine contacted him when the book was coming out, and he said something to the reporter like, the name is familiar, but the rest of it just isn't true. It's the continual just negation. I think, you know, thank God I am successful, and thank God I do have a life of my own, and I'm not dependent on confirmation from these people. But it is a fascinating kind of a story, and really about how people talk with their behavior, and they have been having the same conversation for, you know, 30-some years.
You're listening to an interview with A.M. Holmes, whose latest book is The Mistress's Daughter. When you talk about how Norman responded, how your father responded when he was contacted, I would like to ask you, this book has been out a while, and I'm sure your family has read it. How have your parents and your brother responded to it?
That's a good question. I gave the book to my mother, my adoptive mother, when it was still in manuscript, because I felt I needed to and I wanted to. And I called her a few days later, and she was crying. I'm like, Mom, what's wrong? She said, I'm reading your book, and it's just so wonderful. You know, it's like, which is very nice. And she really says she thinks it's the best thing I've ever written. She really likes how honest it is. She knows that it's all painfully true. There's also moments where she doesn't come off so well. You know, when my biological mother, Ellen, died, my mom was on the phone. She was the one, interestingly, again, like the adoptee never as a grown-up, she got the phone call saying that my biological mother had died. And my mother's first comment, no joking, was, I'm not going to the funeral. And I had to say, Mom, you know what? This isn't about you. It's about me. The possibility of a funeral with you right now, I just need to deal with this for a minute. But literally her first reaction was, you know, sort of protective of herself, but was, I can't go to the funeral.
And your father? Your adopted father?
My adoptive father is a very, soft-spoken isn't even the right word. I would say a man of very few words. And he really is sort of the classic kind of artist and intellectual. And for him, the book just goes into his pile. There's no hierarchy. It's a very socialist system. He will read it when he reads it. But the sense I have from him is that they really are very proud of me, and they've been very supportive. And the interesting thing, too, is that I've never had to feel worried about my material. I remember when The End of Alice came out, you know, this book about the jailed pedophile murderer, and my mother said something to me. I said, Mom, they're going to print a lot of copies of this book. And she goes, really, why? I said, well, Mom, you know, I think they think people will be really interested. I can't imagine why people want to read a book like that. And my father said to me one day something like, so you feel pretty good about this book, same End of Alice. I said, well, yeah. And he goes, and that film fella, he really liked it. John Waters, who had called and said, you know, he really enjoyed the book. I said, well, yeah. And he goes, oh, you're entitled to your opinion. They're wonderful, but they are characters in their own right. And yet I feel lucky to have had them as parents. They really are people who live for the arts. They really are people who are politically very interesting and very active. I mean, my father's 88 years old and is, you know, running some elder artist league. He's going on Grey Panthers marches. He's got meetings happening at their house all the time. I think it's amazing. I mean, they are wonderful examples.
And your brother?
I think it's harder for my brother in some way. My brother is somebody who is also an artist. He does not have a particular career. He does not have a big life. And I think it is difficult for him to certainly read what I would write about the family. And I think even in many ways my success is difficult for him. I was just in England a couple weeks ago because the book won an award. And I actually had my brother with me. And that was really nice for me, because I think as we all get a little bit older, I want him in my life and I want to share my life with him. But, you know, I have a weird life.
Have you heard at all? I mean, one of the things about the book is that it's clear Norman Hecht and his wife and the one son who knew had conspired to keep everyone else from his family from knowing. But now they've all found out. Has anybody contacted you?
I haven't heard from any of the other stepchildren. And I think they all found out actually a while ago, and one of them intercepted among the last letters I sent to Norman saying, Norman, if you can't like deal with telling your children, I can't deal with having a relationship with you because it's too painful.
How about the Ballmans?
The Ballmans, I tried as part of my research for this book to contact some of them. Some of them are here in California, actually. And the Ballmans are an interesting crowd of people. It's just fascinating. I talked with one of them while I was writing the book. And I tried several times to contact his sister, who had apparently been very close to my mother. And she's a very successful sort of scientist person and just never returned my calls and never had any interest. I think, again, it's damned arrogant to just think you have no, I don't know, obligation to your family, obligation to the cousin you loved's child, even say something about this is who we are. But, you know, it is fascinating. I mean, I am at heart, you know, I'm a novelist, but it's about being a social observer and seeing how people handle things. And it's just sort of riveting.
A.M. Holmes, the second half of the book takes us into genealogy. And at one point I was looking a little bit into my genealogy, which is very difficult because my family, as I discovered through that, was Lithuanian and all the records were destroyed during World War II. I was in Salt Lake. We don't appear in the genealogy, which is a good thing, perhaps.
Well, it means you haven't been made into a Mormon yet.
But it's fascinating that you were able to find so much online using places, I guess, Yahoo groups, Googling.
Using Mormon sites.
Really?
Yeah, I think that actually a lot of the genealogy sites are owned by the Mormons, and they really do have a lot of information. And also little groups and all, and big groups, and when I was digging around in Maryland stuff, you find historians different places. I mean, that part to me was among the kind of most addictive and most amazing, which was finding not just my roots, but everybody's roots. And I would sit there in the New York archives and going through, you know, death certificates from the 1920s and seeing, you know, 13-year-old boy came from Germany at age 11, dies of pneumonia on East 2nd Street. It was pathology and humanity, and it was really about American history and world history, and it made me think about things I'd never thought about. You know, why people come to a country at a certain point, and that my adoptive father telling me that his father walked from Russia to Finland to, like, catch a ride to come to America, and realizing, even thinking about what these people really were leaving and why they had to leave. And even the first relative I found was from 1564 in England, and I kept thinking, why did somebody leave this, you know, fancy life in England in 1564 to come to Maryland? And it was explained to me that he probably was not the oldest son, so he was not going to inherit the land, but the king would give him a land grant in America. And he had indentured servants, so he made a beeline.
It also sounds as if on the dead ends, the Hechts who weren't related, the Ballmans and their ancestors, you could get really lost in the minutiae of other people's lives, lives that are absolutely forgotten unless someone is willing to search.
Yeah, I mean, but that to me was also what was so amazing in finding in New York City this whole set of files called the lunacy files. They're all stamped lunacy, and they're people who, for various reasons, were committed to state hospitals in New York. And they're amazing stories of many cases, immigrants who came who had either mental illness or who became mentally unstable and were committed to these asylums. But what I also kept thinking about is it makes sense to me that you would come from Germany and essentially be in this new environment and you would lose your mind. I mean, how could you not in some way? And where it all came from, and just even one guy who had been in an accident and hit his head and then he sort of deteriorated, I just found it truly like you couldn't put it down in some way.
And then in your book, we come to this strange deposition, which is the key to it is what we spoke of before, which is your natural father's fear you might sue, or your idea that maybe that was one of something going on in his head.
What the deposition really grew out of was we went back and asked my biological father for a copy of the DNA test, which he said he would not provide, and then he said he didn't have it anymore. He'd given it to his lawyer. So the lawyer then said he'd had it, but he'd lost it. And it made me think, you know, how often would you keep your lawyer if he kept losing things for you, like your DNA test and stuff? And then the people I was working with were saying, well, you know, you really should sue him for paternity. And the first thing that would happen if we were to sue him for paternity would be, in fact, a deposition. So I thought a lot about what would the questions of that deposition be.
But the questions get stranger and stranger, and as it goes on, it becomes more of an A.M. Holmes novel than an actual deposition.
Well, it's all the things that you would want to know, and you never would have a chance to ask. And the fact is, he would be obligated to answer them in that situation.
A.M. Holmes, we have just a few minutes left. I'd like to ask you a little about other parts of your career, if that's okay. How did you get involved with the L Word?
I wanted to write a TV show. And, you know, working in television essentially is a catch-22. You're not allowed to work in television until you've worked in television. And I knew some of the people that the characters on the L Word were based on. And I basically said, you know, I want to work on this show. And so I literally just wrote Eileen Chaikin an email. And I said, I want to come work on the show. And she emailed back like, okay. It was that hard.
And then you flew out to L.A.?
Yeah. And then I came out here. I came out during the second season to really help them figure out some story stuff that they were struggling with. And I had a great time doing it. It was the first job I had since 1985. I worked one time in my life for 1 year at Random House. And my big anxiety was, can I work? Can I actually go to a job every day? Will I be able to stay awake? Will I, you know, not have a nervous breakdown? Am I even capable of holding a job? And it sounds funny, but it was really kind of serious. I really didn't know if I could do it. And it was exciting to find not only I could actually function, but I could actually function at a really high level and bring a lot to the show. And then I came back the second year as a writer-producer, and I brought in people like Adam Rapp, because I thought, you know, a lesbian show needs more straight men and things like that. And I just had a great time doing it.
And how did the search for your parents and all of that, had that taken such a backseat at that point? Were you considering writing this book at that point?
I was working on the memoir for a very long time, and the memoir was sort of cooking along in its own way. There were times when I was working on the memoir where I would go from New York City up to Yaddo, an artist colony. I really had to step out of my life and really step forward into my soul and into my most private self and do that away from the rest of my life.
You're also drifting between fiction and nonfiction. I mean, does that create any kind of bifurcation in your brain?
No. I feel like the fiction is very much fiction, and I really, that is where I live, and I like to be in my imagination. It gives me great pleasure and also really relief. I don't think I'm all that reality-centered. I find real life painful and difficult, and I found writing this memoir really at times excruciating, but I also was committed to, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it as accurately as I can, and I'm not going to run away from things, and I'm just going to deal with what it brings up. I've tended for a long time to be somebody who likes to do a lot of work in a lot of different media, hence the TV stuff, the film stuff. I do a lot of writing about art. For me, instead of taking a real work break between writing books and things, I tend to take a break where I do something, another kind of writing. And when I'm stuck on a novel, I then will just go and write like an art piece, or I'll go and write, you know, some TV thing. It's like a little ecosystem for me.
Are you working on a novel now or then?
So I accidentally finished 10 years worth of work all at once, so I'm exhausted right now. The novel that came out last year, This Book Will Save Your Life, is still coming out sort of all over the world. So I've been chasing that. I've been making notes for a new piece of fiction. I want to write something that's kind of like a cross between Charlotte's Web and, I don't know, some sort of Beckett thing. I will assume already that it will be my greatest failure, because now I just have to. I think coming off this book has been very difficult. And I'm also actually developing a show for HBO, my own show for HBO, a family saga set in the Hamptons.
In a recent interview, you said that people have lost access to their imaginations. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean it quite seriously. I think that American culture, sort of post-World War II, for a while there, when you look at major figures like Martin Luther King talking about having a dream and John Kennedy talking about his vision of a certain kind of society and politicians that ran on their hopes for this country and their ideas. And now we have politicians who run saying, I will give you $350 back. I will give you a tax rebate if you vote for me. No one has ever processed how much that tax rebate costs the average family. I think we've lost our ability to imagine. I think we've lost our ability to dream. And I think you see it in everything from the focus of nonfiction and the way that people think that, you know, memoir is it in some way. I think you see it in the whole thing of reality TV. Every time I write a novel and I go on tour for it, people say to me, so is it all true? I'm thinking, no, it's absolutely not true. This is a novel. And when I taught for many years at Columbia University, it was incredibly hard work to get the students to truly engage their imaginations and extend beyond their own experience. I also think it's something about the world we live in that's a very kind of narcissistic world where we all just look at our own experience and kind of don't get beyond ourselves. So it's actually a worry for me. I think it's indicative of larger problems in American culture. And I think European culture, interestingly, still has a lot of imagination. I mean, you look at the literature coming out of Europe, and it is expansive and it is broad. And you look at American literature, and it's fairly narrow.
We could even say that at this point, I don't think an American could have made a film like Pan's Labyrinth.
No, an American couldn't have made a film like Pan's Labyrinth.
I keep thinking, I mean, there's this thing bouncing in my brain, and it's three words, George Bush's America. And it seems that in the past 6 years, it's like we've fallen off a cliff artistically, creatively, culturally, politically.
And I think we fell off right around the time of Watergate. And I mean that pretty literally. If you look at, like, if you think about American culture from sort of the 1970s forward, I mean, look at our dance, look at our films, look at our books and our music. It's not where it should be. And there was a point where, you know, American art was so incredibly vibrant and interesting. And then British art, which had always been kind of not so great, kind of just eclipsed us. And then young German artists have really come out incredibly strong. I think there is a kind of a cultural just blank out there. And I think we're kind of starting to get our footing again. I just finished judging Grant as Best American Writers Under 35, or as I accidentally call it, Best American Writers Not Yet Born. And I was surprised to see there were a lot of really good writers, a lot of writers who were not necessarily American-born, were not necessarily white Americans, but really the most interesting were people who were, you know, people who had originated in other countries and who were here and who were working incredibly expansively and on interesting themes and on themes of other cultures and other worlds.
Do you think we can recover from the black period of the past 6 years, which I think has been, I mean, you talk about going back 30 years, but to me the past 6 years have been such a horror.
I think they have been a horror. I think one of the things is that we would have to wake up and we would have to take responsibility. And I think it's amazing to me how little responsibility American people are willing to take for their own government and for even saying, you know what, something is wrong here. This is not okay with me. We're just kind of like bumping our way through it like, you know, turbulence in an airplane, but we're not actually saying, you know what, this is enough and we are going to stop this. I mean, I think the last election actually was obviously a very good sign in that sense, but it's still absolutely a worry. And I think the other worry of it is that the damage that has been caused by these 6 years will take, you know, 60 years to recover from, if that. I mean, we're also, even the thing of finding out about all these, you know, laws and bills and things that he signed without anybody even knowing it, or I don't know if they're laws and bills, but, you know, the whole notion of sort of the executive power and that he's done tons of stuff that we know nothing about. Even the whole thing where they were making all presidential papers, no one can have access to them anymore. So there go what, all the biographies, all the historians just can't write anymore? So you can't write a book about George Bush because, what, it might hurt his feelings?
A.M. Holmes. Now, the book has been finished for several months, and it's out in print, it's out in the world. When you look at it and at the world, what do you see yourself having done, and on some level, can you detect even what kind of changes just writing it has created for you?
On one level, my biggest concerns when I was finishing it and launching it into the world were really about my immediate family and about my biological family. I didn't write it to be hurtful to people, and yet I know that it is a painful book for people, and for those, especially those people closely related to me. I think as I'm on book tour, the book accomplishes what I wanted to do, which is that it has a lot of meaning for people, and it has meaning for people who are adopted because it fits with their concerns and people who have given up children and have adopted children in that world, but also for people who are questioning just how does my life work and who am I? And the kind of response that I've gotten from people for this memoir is very different from a novel. From a novel, I hear, I really like your fiction. I enjoy the story about, you know, this guy a lot. And all the email I'm getting from this book starts like this. I'm 38 years old. I'm 42 years old. Here is my story. It's incredibly affecting and important. And I think the reason to write a book like this and put it into the world is the hope that it will have meaning for people, and also that it prompts a discussion, and that the discussion is about the fact that adoption, whether for a birth mother, a family, an adoptee, is a lifelong process, and also that for people who are not adopted, the question of who am I is a universal question. And how do we relate or not relate to our families? Or how do we begin to even think about the validity of those kind of family historical narratives is an incredibly important question that we all are asking or need to ask at some point in our lives. It's nice for me to hear from people who are touched by this book, because it was really, really painful to write, and I feel better when I know that it means something to somebody.
Even more than your novels?
Yeah, yeah.
You've been listening to an interview with A.M. Holmes, whose latest book is The Mistress's Daughter. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.